BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're listening to Front Row with John Wilson.
Good evening. We're live from Broadcasting House with another supersized Front Row Friday. Limbering up in Reykjavik is our artist in lockdown residence, pianist Víkingur Ólafsson. Get ready to sew, stitch, carve and stick as we hear how the crafts that we do with our hands are also good for our minds. And author Sarah Collins and critic Karen Grzanovic are with me to review two new releases, a novel from Lionel Shriver, which satirises middle-aged fitness fanaticism, and a Netflix series called Hollywood, which offers a counterfactual twist on Tinseltown.
Vivian, maybe I'd like to introduce you to a client. This is Rock Hudson.
Pleasure.
Hi. So I take it you're in Gone with the Wind?
Hollywood, the new Netflix series, coming up soon. But let's head straight to Reykjavik to join Iceland's keyboard wizard Víkingur Ólafsson, who was Gramophone magazine's Artist of the Year in 2019. Whilst most musicians are locked out of concert halls in 2020, Víkingur has been taking to the stage of the Harper Concert Hall every week to perform live for Front Row as our artist in residence. And what a treat these performances have been. Last week's Bach organ sonata was so beautiful that it made me cry. Luckily, I was listening at home in my kitchen, not in the Front Row studio. But now that I'm here, Víkingur, hopefully you're going to play us something a bit more upbeat and fortifying this week. What have you chosen?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if it's upbeat. There's actually quite a lot of anguish in it. But we're going to go to New York and very much to Manhattan, and I'm going to play some Philip Glass for you.
Fabulous.
I think I'll play from his set of 20 etudes, etude number 9. It has this kind of anguish to it. It has this going. You know, so I don't know if you'll feel particularly upbeat, but maybe you will. It's very much good. It's very good music for Friday. I always feel Philip Glass. It gives you this kind of energy to go into the weekend. I very often play it for myself if I happen to be at home, you know, on a Friday, but usually I'm somewhere preparing for a concert.
Yes. Glass is now in his early 80s. I think he's 83, isn't he? Once the radical young composer, now such an esteemed elder statesman of music and still often called a minimalist. He probably hates that term. But what do you understand by that term musically?
Well, I think basically, you know, maybe he was a minimalist in the late 60s and early 70s. And then, you know, he was using very limited material and really repeating it and doing sort of processes with it. I think these days he's using repetition for structural element, but I think he's much more of a post-romantic composer, if you ask me. And I think it's crazy that he's 83 because, you know, I know him personally, and when you're with him in the same room, you know, I feel like the old man. He has so much sort of creative energy. He makes everyone else look old. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the minimalism, it's a problematic term, but so are all the other terms in music and art history in general. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago we were talking about, I think, Debussy, you know, Impressionism is equally bad as minimalism. Everybody who's called a minimalist hates it, no? I mean, I've heard John Adams be called a minimalist. Same with Steve Reich. I think they all hate it.
They also hate. I mean, I talked to Philip Glass on this program a few years ago, and I think it's up there on today's program page of the Front Row website, that Front Row special. He was absolutely fascinating, but I do remember when I mentioned the repetition in his music, he really took umbrage at that. He hates the idea that it is just all about repetition. Why is that, Víkingur?
Well, I think actually the idea of repetition is somewhat misunderstood. It's not a repetition. It's sort of an opportunity to maybe rediscover a familiar object, to find always a new perspective, even if you're looking at the same object. And I think if you take something like Opening, you know, one of his most famous works, it starts like this. But you could play the same notes and you can completely bring something else out. Let's put it like this. And it becomes this kind of tragic song. Or you could make it like you're seeing inside of a clock. You know, you can make it like. And there you really hear the polyrhythm, the 2 against 3, and the long notes, you know, and then the bass. But I think, you know, the idea of sort of minimalism and the repetition, it can't be repetition, not as long as time goes on in a forward direction. There's a 2,000-year-old saying that goes something like, "You cannot step twice into the same river," and that's how I very much feel when I play this music.
That's a great saying, and applies perfectly to Philip Glass. Okay, let's hear Philip Glass's Etude. I think you're doing number 9, aren't you? This is Víkingur Ólafsson live from the Harper Concert Hall in Reykjavik. That is absolutely wonderful. Víkingur Ólafsson playing Philip Glass's Etude, number 9, live from the Harper Concert Hall. I'm not crying tonight. I'm energising up for anything on a Friday night after that one, Víkingur. Do you know what I'm really fascinated by? Because you're in that concert hall. It's a beautiful space. And we can hear, as you play there, the natural reverberation. And there are kind of echoes in that piece. You know, you're sort of emulating the idea of the echo within those cascading notes. How does the emptiness of the hall affect your performance, given the extra space around you?
It really affects the performance. I mean, so much. I can't even tell you. The tempos, the use of pedal, the kind of articulation and the texture more than anything, how you balance the left against the right hand, how your palate really goes. I think, you know, especially with this music and with the kind of idea of, you know, repetition or non-repetition, you really go into this kind of sort of laboratory where you're really sort of exploring the space in yourself. And I think
as you're playing itself,
absolutely. And I think the music itself asks for that. You know, it's, you know, Philip Glass adheres very much to Eastern kind of philosophy. I think the narrative is not so linear. It's more sort of spacious. He creates sort of space for reflection. Not so much perhaps in this piece, but certainly in his slower music. So I think it's always it always becomes, you know, you don't have to repeat yourself when you play Philip Glass. You know, it's sort of like an open canvas, and then you sort of fill in the colors of the day if you wish.
Absolutely fascinating. Víkingur, thank you very much. And by the way, Berlin Philharmonic are returning to their concert hall tonight, also, for the first time, for a live concert, which will be streamed on their website. Be really interested to hear what a whole orchestra sounds like in an empty concert hall. But as you say, there is a difference. You can hear the space and the sound, and it's bouncing back at you from the walls, isn't it?
It's so strange to play for all of you in an empty hall, but I know there are so, I get so many messages, and I know there are so many people listening, so it's a strange feeling. It's very paradoxical, but I'm so happy for this live line that you're giving me here as a performing
pianist.
It means a lot to me.
Well, and we're going to talk again and hear you Thursday next week, not Friday, Thursday. I'll be back here, and I'm looking forward to that. You're playing Ramo next week. Víkingur Ólafsson, thanks very much indeed. And thanks to the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service for bringing us these weekly live broadcasts from the Harper Concert Hall. You can hear tonight's performance again on the Radio 3 Breakfast Show on Monday morning with Petrarch Trelawney. Every Friday, we're taking on some of Saturday Review's critical duties whilst it's temporarily off-air. This week, we have a new novel from Lionel Shriver and a Netflix drama up for discussion. Hollywood is a big-budget series created by showrunner Ryan Murphy, who brought us Glee and Pose. He's reported to have signed a 5-year contract with Netflix worth $300 million, a deal that so far produced the high school series The Politician. The new one, Hollywood, is set amidst the film studios, the Beverly Hills mansions and the Sunset Strip bars of Los Angeles in the late 1940s, a time when race and sexuality could decide success on the screen as much as artistic ability. In Ryan Murphy's counterfactual vision of Hollywood, fictional wannabes rub shoulders with the likes of Rock Hudson, Noel Coward, Anna May Wong and Vivian Lee, and overcome prejudice with their starry-eyed talent. There's even a version of a real-life garage where stars and civilians alike found services of a different kind.
Look, kid, this town's all about dreams, right? You know that. And some of my customers don't just come here for gas. They have fantasies and desires. And for them, it ain't enough to watch a fantasy up on the big screen. They want it for themselves, and I provide that for them. In a way, I'm no different than Louis B. Mayer. You know what I mean?
No, Arnie, I have no idea what you mean.
You see, some of them say a secret code word. You get in the car with them, have a drink maybe, and sometimes you have to service them.
Dylan McDermott and David Corenswet in a scene from Hollywood. Joining me from her home is Sarah Collins, author of the Costa Award-winning debut novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. And here in the studio, socially distanced, of course, is critic Karen Krasanovich. Karen, did you enjoy this counterfactual approach from Ryan Murphy with Hollywood?
Well, it's surprising and revising, as they're saying. I did, actually, because there's a lot to discuss here. There's a lot that rankles, there's a lot that seems wrong, and yet it is a starry-eyed, fresh, revisionist take on a big Hollywood what-if.
Sarah, it's a blend of history and fantasy, in a way, isn't it? Did that work for you?
I'm afraid I'm going to play the contrarian because halfway through watching the first episode of this series, I found myself writing in my notebook a question, a kind of plea, really, which is, what is the point of this? Because although it was supposed to be offering wish fulfillment, and I could see all of the potential in this kind of alternative history, you know, the triumph against racism and homophobia and ageism and all the rest of it, it just felt to me like there was nothing at stake. There was an air of unreality, which completely flattened the whole thing, in my view.
Karen, Hollywood in the 40s was racist and homophobic and ageist, which does beg the question, you know, and defend it. What is the point of it?
And sexist as well. I watched all of it. I watched all the way through. I still haven't forgiven the costume designer for Patti LuPone's outrageous outfits.
Hang on, but you've done what? 12, 13 episodes?
I've done all of them, yes.
Wow.
Yes, I have.
You got to the Oscars.
What I did, in fact. What I thought the point of it was, it's like children getting together and saying, let's make Hollywood fair. Let's see what happens. And I thought that that was an interesting exercise. But I think the real point of this is not only a kind of candy-coated revisionist, I'm sure that if it was like this back then, Hollywood would be different now, which it possibly would be. But I also think it's dreamy, it's discursive, and I think it's good that someone did it. And I think this could lead to more interesting productions later on.
Yes. Sarah, I found the tone curiously uneven as well. Sometimes playing for laughs with, you know, heavyweight subject matter.
Yes. And then at other times, reaching almost for something that connected emotionally. So, you know, I went from an abominable first episode to an average second one, which then elevated itself with moments like Darren Criss, who's playing a director who gets a film greenlit, largely because he's passing. He's half Asian, half Filipino, but he can pass as white. And there's this one wonderful scene where he says, movies don't just show us how the world is. They show us how the world can be. And that was the tone I thought that the whole series was reaching for and ended up unevenly obtaining at odd points, odd moments like that.
People do love Ryan Murphy's work, Pose and Glee and even The Politician, which we discussed here on Front Row, which I thought was okay, not as good as his earlier work. What sort of audience will this series find, do you think?
Well, if that one is from me,
sorry,
then I
Sarah,
suppose
I
it's people who. I can't see you because I'm very well socially distanced at home. But it, no, I think people who are looking for a bit of escapism, and that's what Ryan Murphy does well. It's not dark. I'm a fan of the kind of Ryan Murphy vehicles that give us darkness, like American Horror Story. This one is definitely candy-coated, but it's escapist. And I think if you want to look back at history and see how it could have been if everything always turned up roses, then it's one for you. If you want something a bit more complicated and a bit more true to human nature, you're probably going to give up at the second episode, as I did.
I think what's interesting, Karen, is there was a sort of an age divide in Hollywood at the time, with, you know, the younger people getting all the good roles and the older people edged out. In this production, we got Patti LuPone here, and she's fantastic. Didn't you find that the older people are out acting all the younger ones to the detriment of the whole production?
I thought that was just me. Yes, they are. Yes. They are. But but they've got more depth, and I think it's because the writing is, as and Sarah's right, there's not enough stakes, there's not enough darkness, but the actors know how to bring that out. There's a lot of Hollywood legends in this, a lot of very experienced people, and that makes a big difference, which is also why Patti LuPone is dressed like a chicken or a rooster. I don't know what the heck she's wearing, but it's terrible.
I couldn't agree more, though. Holland Taylor and Patti LuPone absolutely make this. They really are the highlights. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much. Karen has done the whole thing. I'm not sure if Sarah is going to be going any further than the second episode. I'll say the third was better than the second, but I'm going to leave it there as well. Also out this week is a new novel from Lionel Shriver, best known for her 2003 prize-winning bestseller We Need to Talk About Kevin. Shriver casts an unflinching eye on her subjects, families, relationships, social conventions, and often writes with a witty, sometimes withering tone. Her new one, The Motion of the Body Through Space, features a 60-something woman called Serenata Terpsichore, a fitness fanatic who's perplexed when her lifelong couch potato husband, Remington, decides to run a marathon.
I have my eye on the race in Saratoga Springs in April. She had the sense, rare in her marriage, that she should watch what she said. This is serious? You're not pulling my leg. Do I often make statements of intent and then pull the rug out? Just fooling? I'm not sure how to take your disbelief as anything but an insult. My disbelief might have something to do with the fact that I've never seen you run from here to the living room.
Maggie Service, reading on behalf of Lionel Shriver there. Sarah, Lionel Shriver does tend to divide readers, doesn't she? She can be a provocateur. How do you rate her as a writer, first of all, before we get to the specifics of this book?
Well, I mean, she's clearly an excellent writer, but the problem is I don't think that amounts to a hill of beans anymore with Shriver's work, because she's not good enough for whatever it is that she's trying to do. I suspect it wouldn't disturb her in the least that I found this novel offensive, but the problem is also I didn't find it a particularly good novel, and it's because she's kind of making a profession of irascibility, it seems. The characters then become less like people and more like hooks on which she's hanging her own opinions. You know, there's a scene in this, the first date, I think, where Serenata says to the man who's going to end up being her husband, you know, I want to be a writer, but I just don't care enough about other people. And I just thought that has to be Shriver herself.
Karen, this book's primary target seems to be the battle against our own bodies, particularly in middle-class white Americans of a certain age. there's a note on your CV here in front of me that says you're a qualified personal trainer.
I am. So, in fact, I am.
So how personally did you take this
novel?
I'm
not wearing Lycra right now, just to let you know I'm not.
I can vouch for that.
Thank you. I thought, what's interesting, and it's a difficult novel to read because it's got a lot of observation, but it's not very likable. You don't, and also what idiotic, I mean, Remington, really, Serenata, honestly.
Serenata. Terpsichore.
No, sheesh. Anyway, but I think what she's looking for, one thing that I can point out that is good about this is that I think she's pointing to, okay, political correctness, opportunities for young people, health for elder people, mature people. These are all the things that we think are going to save us. And she points and says, these will not save us. And I think she's really examining all of our beliefs and what they're going to do for us.
Let me throw that back to Sarah, because you said a moment ago that you're a bit offended possibly by this novel. Lionel Shriver is no stranger to controversy, and she's attracted attention in recent years for her comments on, you know, diversity targets in publishing. And diversity also features here, as Karen suggests, in this novel. The husband loses his job when he's deemed to have intimidated his younger female black boss. Is she making a point that quality should always triumph over quotas? And is that successfully argued, do you think?
I don't think she's making a point. I think Shriver would be sitting back, waiting for me to fall into the trap she thinks she's cleverly set of being offended. And then, you know, she lays all of these sort of mines throughout the novel, which is an argument against anyone who's going to find this offensive. But the problem is she hasn't complicated anything. She's offering us stereotypes and caricatures, and she's doing it. There's a kind of merging of her notoriously offensive persona with her work that in a way that reminds me of V.S. Naipaul. You know, all they want to do is piss people off. And so, you know, I just was left feeling flat. Yes, I'm offended, but who cares? She hasn't really tapped in enough to anything important about humanity for me to feel that strongly about it. You know, I love a good, unlikable female narrator myself, but not one who's asking me to decide whether she's racist or not. That just isn't the point of reading a novel, I don't think.
I would echo a lot of what Sarah says there, Karen. I think one of my problems with it is, and Sarah mentioned the narrator, I couldn't read this book without hearing Lionel Shriver's voice. That's the problem. Same problem I have with a lot of Will Self stuff as well. You can't engage yourself with the characters. She hands you these characters and says, you know, get on with it, like them or not.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she's not working hard to really entrance us in the story she's telling. And this is the problem, that she feels that she's so right. It's actually coming through her writing. And it is quite difficult to read, I agree.
What is good about this book? I mean, what were you engaged by?
As I said, I thought the fact that she was willing to look at everything that we think is good or bad and what it's doing for us. What is a 65-year-old running a marathon? What good is that? What good is the fact that she's wrecked this character, she's wrecked her knees? What good is her mentioning that her husband's lost his job? What are these things supposed to be doing? And I thought that took quite a good eye, but the rest of it,
That's a concept, not a novel. Exactly.
Those are concepts, yes.
Yeah, it is very much a concept. It's like a personal essay or a polemic. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if there was one thing I enjoyed, it was the hilarity, intentional or unintentional, of reading about someone who feels so superior that she thinks she invented sushi and scrunchies. I mean, it was just, that bit was just delightful.
I think we're going to have to leave it there before we damn this novel any further. Sarah Collins, thank you very much. And also to Karen Krasanovich here in the studio. Lionel Shriver's The Motion of the Body Through Space is published by HarperCollins. Some bookshops are still delivering. Lionel Shriver is on Woman's Hour next Thursday. Hollywood is on Netflix from today. Thanks very much to Sarah and to Karen. Tony Allen, one of the greatest drummers of all time, who provided the polyrhythmic backbeat for Africa 70, the band led by Nigerian superstar Fela Kuti, has died, aged 79. In recent years, he teamed up with Damon Albarn for several musical projects, and I was lucky enough to sit next to Tony as he soundchecked his drums for an edition of master tapes that we were making. I was astonished by the fluidity of his movement around the kit as he appeared to be playing in three different time signatures at once. In 2014, here on Front Row, Tony Allen told me when he had first started playing the drums, surprisingly late.
At the age of 20.
You'd never played the drums before the age of 20?
No.
Were you always tapping? Were you always making rhythms?
I was just kind of like a spectator. I didn't want to play any other instrument than drums because it's just the kind of instrument that looks like the magical for me.
And I think you once described the drum kit as like an orchestra in its own right. Everything's there.
Yeah.
How can that be?
It's just an orchestra. If it's played like an orchestra, if it's not bashed, it's if you kind of caress it, it will sound like orchestra. Because you see one guy sitting down there with four limbs, you know, and he has to make use of the four limbs, you know. So
four limbs, and in your case, four limbs all playing different rhythms sometimes than the polyrhythms that you create.
Yeah, exactly.
And you are a pioneer. You are the man who, with Fela Kuti, invented the idea of Afrobeat. Did you, at the time when you were working with Fela and coming up with these new rhythms and fusing the traditional African rhythms with the funk and the soul that was emerging from America, were you consciously thinking, we'll do something new?
Fela had the idea of trying to do something that nobody ever did before. When we started, you know, you're always writing things for everybody. But, you know, if he writes for me, I'm not playing what he wrote down there. It's not possible, you know, because he cannot write drums. He can just have ideas of, he can even make his mouth to say tak, 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 or whatever, but he cannot, even when he writes it down, it's no way to play like that.
Yes.
Sometimes when he writes, he asks me, what do you play, what are you going to play on this now? I say, well, I have to check it out. Let me check it out. And I might play three different things, and he'd say, oh yeah, let's keep this one.
Right, so he would choose, you'd give him different options. Yeah. I guess you would never play the same thing twice though, would you? Because even though the idea of Afrobeat and what Fela was doing was fusing some of the tradition of the Nigerian rhythms with the funk that was amazing, and James Brown, but your influences, from what I understand, are more Max Roach and Art Blakey and
playing,
people like that.
You know, it's the playing. For instance, if you see there are a lot of Afrobeat drummers today that want to play Afrobeat. They're playing in Afrobeat bands, but the problem is that most of them yet never got the technique. Four limbs doing different things at the same time.
Four limbs doing different things at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I always tell them that there's no any magic to it. Just use your mind. Don't think about four things. You just think about one thing going. That's my only advice I could give to them, because I cannot hold their hands and legs to do it for them. I've done it, but it doesn't work.
Jealousy, track from the great Nigerian drummer Tony Allen, who has died. Like ballroom dancing and cake baking, you would have thought that a sewing competition would be an unlikely television format to succeed in the 21st century. And yet the BBC's Great British Sewing Bee has been a ratings winner in recent years. What's more, the latest show is even more popular in lockdown, with a new series being watched by nearly 6 million people. That's 2 million more than the last series. Meanwhile, Channel 4 has been offering a lockdown show hosted by Kirsty Allsop called Keep Crafting and Carry On. In a moment, I'll be talking to two crafty people who will be offering tips on making things at home. But first, some evidence that suggests that sewing, stitching and gluing is not just practical, but can also be of psychological benefit. I'm joined by Daisy Fancourt of University College London, who's undertaking the COVID-19 social study, the largest study on mental health in the UK during the pandemic, with over 80,000 participants. Daisy, welcome to Front Row. You're leading this huge study of the impact on people's mental health of this lockdown. What kind of things have you been looking at, first of all? Set it in context.
So we're interested in the whole psychological and social impact on the virus on people. So this is, for example, things like depression, anxiety, loneliness, different stresses and worries. And we're also looking at people's behaviours, so their health behaviours, but also how they're spending their time. So people are taking part every week and we're analysing the data in real time so we can produce results and reports every few days for people, showing what's changing.
And what have you found so far?
Well, there have been some very interesting findings on mental health. So, for example, we know that prior to the lockdown, in the few weeks leading up to the lockdown, there were increases in levels of mental illness. So people were feeling much more anxious and depressed than normal, and their well-being went down. Now, this stabilised when the lockdown was brought in, but we're still seeing significantly higher numbers of people than usual reporting levels of anxiety and depression that we would consider above a particular threshold to be worrying. And we've seen ever so slight decreases in this, but not very much, to be honest. So in other words, a lot of people are being very badly affected by the lockdown. But at the same time, we have seen a few promising things. So people's life satisfaction has been gradually creeping up towards a more normal level. And we've also seen decreases in certain stresses. So, for example, people are less worried about catching COVID at the moment at home, and also worries about getting food access to food have decreased around fourfold since the lockdown began.
Right. OK, well, let's look at the artistic, the creative aspect. Anecdotally, we're hearing that a lot of people are being, you know, spending their time being very creative behind locked doors at home. Have you looked, have you specifically studied those sort of creative activities and the benefits, the health benefits, mental health benefits that they could have?
Absolutely. This is a big interest to us in terms of, are these creative activities helping to buffer perhaps some of the negative effects of this time on our mental health? So we've been looking at people's levels of creative engagement, and we know that about 70% of people are listening to music day to day, and about 50% are reading for pleasure. Now, this is fairly normal numbers, but we're actually finding that one in three people is doing an arts activity in their spare time at the moment. And one in 10 people have been trying an online or digital arts activity, which is obviously a fairly new phenomenon for a lot of people.
One in 10 people. But I mean, are those figures higher than they would have been before lockdown? Is there evidence in your survey to suggest that people are engaged in a way that they weren't before?
We're currently looking at this comparing with some previous data, so we're going to know that very soon. And also, we've got a new section of the study that's coming in next week, where we're going to be asking a lot more detail about how people's habits have changed compared to prior to lockdown. But for now, I think it's interesting that we're seeing that these things are being done by people. And there are some interesting patterns as well. For example, we're finding that there's no difference in age amongst who's engaging in these digital or virtual arts activities. So it's interesting to know that lots and lots of people across all age groups are thinking this is something that's worthwhile doing.
Mm. Of course, a lot of the benefits of arts participation or joining crafts groups or whatever are associated with interaction, socialising, getting out, meeting people. Will people get the same benefits from meeting up online? We're going to hear about that in a moment. But do you think scientifically, in terms of the study that you're doing, whether there is still that socialisation that's going and the mental health benefits if people are meeting via screens rather than face to face in clubs?
We think this actually might be the case. And the reason is we actually conducted a study about a year ago, which was considered very niche at the time, but was looking at the differences between engaging in live choirs and virtual choirs via the internet. Now, this has become incredibly pertinent in the current situation. And so what we found in this study was that people got very similar emotional benefits from the live and the virtual choir experiences, but there was a lot more variability in how socially present people felt. So for some people, they felt connected to others. They felt it had been a sociable experience. For others, it just did not feel sociable in the slightest. So I think we're going to have to find out from this study a bit more about who actually buys into this and gets benefits from it. And people can help by taking part if they'd like to by going to covid19study.org.
Mm. OK, and what about if you are pursuing your creative endeavours at home alone? Are there still the benefits? Are you finding there are still benefits from what people are telling you?
Absolutely, yes. We know there are a number of ways that doing activities, even on your own, can help with mental health. These things can help to distract you from worries. They can also help you to have sort of time and space to process and think about what's going on, perhaps vent any negative emotions or reappraise problems. They can boost our self-confidence so we feel more capable of tackling challenges. They can give us a sense of purpose, and they can also just give a routine and structure to our days as well.
Okay, well, let's hear now about the sort of things that people could be doing at home. Daisy Fancourt, thanks very much indeed. And by the way, that website that Daisy mentioned there, the details I think are on our Front Row website at the moment, so you can join Daisy's study if you'd like to. Now I'm joined by two people who have been leading interactive online craft tutorials. Embroiderer Ake to Call makes hand-stitched maps. We're going to be hearing a bit more about that in a moment. And Joe Hartley works primarily as a potter, but uses all sorts of materials in his work as a product designer. Ake to, is stitching therapeutic for you personally?
Very much so. Just as we were going into lockdown and all those worries were really primarily at the front of our minds about food and how this will impact us and me personally as an artist, what impact it would have on my practice. I found that the minute I took up the needle and the thread and then just sat down, I instantly felt a sense of calm. It was, it's just been so meditative and therapeutic to carry on making. especially now that, all the deadlines have suddenly disappeared.
But is that something about the process of stitching? Because it requires such precision and it requires such kind of quiet concentration, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think there's something about the rhythmic flow of the needle and the thread, the kind of complete focus it requires, that you can almost feel your thoughts that have been racing around your head slow down. I personally tend to observe my thoughts more, I'm more aware of them. And I find that the online sessions that I have been doing recently, people have responded so positively to them.
Well, I'm quite surprised to hear that, because you wouldn't have thought that embroidery was a team sport. It wasn't particularly a social activity. So tell us something about these tutorials are called Stitch and Soothe. What happens in the sessions?
Well, the intention is really to use embroidery as a tool to soothe our nerves, to provide a spot of calm from the chaos of the day. I have two young children, so between homeschooling them and parenting and trying to carry on with my creative work, that 1 hour when I sit down and exchange thoughts with other like-minded people is just absolutely lovely. And you were talking about it's not being a team sport, but actually, it is. Historically, people have used embroidery to express themselves, to tell stories, and it has been the culture of bringing people together and them collectively embroidering something has long existed in many, many cultures.
I've been looking at some of your embroidery online. As I mentioned a moment ago, you're creating images of maps, so a sense of the globe, the world, big wide world out there, even though we're, locked down in our homes. In these sessions that you're leading, are the people following your work? Are you showing them what you do and leading the way, or is it a free-for-all?
They have a loose structure. We choose words. We've all, I think, found solace in reading in poetry or prose. Everyone brings a word that they find uplifting, or words, a piece of poem, and then we embroider that. And I give some instructions as to how they might do it. I show them some examples. Oftentimes there's a reading. Someone would read a poem.
Lovely. Let me just bring Jo Hartley in now, because Jo, I mentioned a moment ago, work as a potter, Jo, don't you? So your practice is different to Aita's. What have you been doing online? What sort of things are you showing people they can make at home with the things? You can't make a pot, you can't spin a pot at home if you don't have the clay and the wheel. So it's really what you have to hand, isn't it, in the kitchen?
Exactly, yeah. So that's a really good point, John. And something we've been trying to do with our workshops is try and work out, I guess I'm essentially a product designer, so I'm looking for products that I can produce with things around the home. And obviously I am a potter, and I have been doing demonstrations on how to throw things on the wheel. And a lot of those things that I've been making, I've been talking about how you can make your own version of those, perhaps using things which aren't necessarily made off the wheel. So we've been doing fermentation workshops. Charlie Manthorpe in London has done a fermentation class, and I did a fermentation crock demonstration on how to throw a fermentation crock. And then it was really nice.
So you better explain it. What is a fermentation crock?
So a fermentation crock is a large ceramic crock in which you put vegetables in it to ferment into things like kimchi and sauerkraut. And although I wouldn't expect people to make a fermentation crock.
Pickles. Pickling vegetables.
Pickles, essentially, yeah. So we've been encouraging people to kind of to make their own pickles using their own things around the house. I've been working with an artist in Cumbria called Tom Phillipson, where we've been sharing things amongst ourselves. So he works a lot in bamboo, and Tom has been showing me how to make products in bamboo. So we've been making coat hooks and whisks out of bamboo. It's basically just out of a garden cane. And Tom showed me how to make them, and I've been showing people how to make them, and also encouraging other people to show other people how to make them.
Right, this is a DIY craft with whatever you can find at home. I mean, just talking to Daisy Fancourt a moment ago and asking her whether she has found that people are engaging more with creative activities. You know, some people would turn their nose up at the word craft. Have you found with your sessions that people have been more engaged, that people have got the time to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily think about?
I think certainly, yeah. And I don't think we tend not really to use the word craft too much, because we've had things like yoga that have happened as well. We've had a lot of drawing, and we've had sessions and a lot of cooking sessions. We've been making pasta as well. So we've tried not to use the word craft, because I guess it kind of then isolates a lot of other things. But something we've found that's been really good, and I've been encouraging it, is the kind of taking part in these sessions and making things enables you to build a body of something, anything that you're making, that then enables you to help quantify the passing of time somehow, which is kind of something personally that I was kind of like, has affected me, this struggling sort of quantifying time passing. And I found that if you're doing something, if you're making something again and again, and if you perhaps change something again and again every day, it allows you to build up a body of something that you can look back at, and you can see how you have developed, or you can see how you can quantify how time is passing. If you see,
I do. That's really fascinating. I hadn't thought about it like that. That's something I guess that you would echo as well, Ekta. Keep working, and it's putting a marker down, isn't it, for this strange time we're living in.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us, Joe Hartley and to Ekta Kaul. You can find Ekta's tutorials via her Instagram page. And Joe's tutorials are via, Joe, I think I've got this right, the Old Bank Residency website. Does that sound right?
That's right, the Old Bank Residency. Good. That's our space. Good. Yeah.
And for further ideas and resources, do try the Craft Council website, even though Joe doesn't like that word. Among the items next week on Front Row, Vikinger Olofsson will be back. He'll be, as I mentioned earlier, playing live on Thursday. And on Monday, another musical treat. Violinist Nicola Benedetti will be here. Don't miss that. Until then, stay safe. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to Front Row this evening, presented by me, John Wilson, produced by the whole Front Row team, most of whom are working from home. But with me in the studio this evening is producer Sarah Johnson and studio manager Matilda Macari. If you'd like to download Front Row as a podcast series, which you should do, head to BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.